The apostolic tradition of St. Hippolytus is a very important document in that it provides us with rather detailed descriptions of liturgies of ordination and thus offers us insight into the theology of those orders and gives us a much clearer sense of the interrelationship between the different orders of the clergy than we might acquire otherwise. There is some intrigue in regard to the document itself. I've provided a rather detailed description of St. Hippolytus and of his text at the very bottom of this page. If you wish to look at it later, he is actually an antipope. That is to say, his supporters set him up as a rival bishop of Rome, and in many ways they were trying to be more orthodox than the orthodox. So his liturgies do not, it is generally generally regarded, represent unique and unusual practices. They are that pertain to a particular group of dissidents. On the contrary, it's a group that was trying to proclaim itself to be the most orthodox, the most legitimate form of authority, and they are much more likely, therefore, to have presented almost slavishly traditional approaches to these various issues. It should be mentioned in passing that Hippolytus and his great rival, and he had a couple of rivals during the period of his life, particularly Pontian and Callistus, and he ended up exiled as a result of his Christianity, as did his great rival, and there is alleged to have been a reconciliation between them in the copper mines of Sardinia. And Hippolytus is celebrated as a saint, and indeed his liturgy is the basis for the second Eucharistic prayer that is used by the Roman Catholic Church today. So for all of his being an antipope, of being a rival, and therefore a schismatic, his text and his life present a very edifying material. The liturgy itself is available in a number of different forms. Some Greek fragments survive. It's available in several different Latin versions, and I've tried to provide what we have of the Greek original as well as what are thought to probably be the best Latin texts in addition to the English translations. If we look first at the Liturgy of Episcopal Election and Ordination, the first section that is on this page, notice that the bishop, the one who is to be ordained, has been chosen by all the people. There is still a sense that the people of God are involved in the election of this individual. Today, of course, in the Liturgy of Ordination, that is found in the applause which the people of God offer once the nomination of the bishop-elect is offered, but before the ordination takes place. One of the places where liturgical applause is most appropriate in that it is here representing the acclamation, which is specifically described as the people giving their consent. The people give consent, and then the presbyters and bishops have come together and are intended to be there. As we'll see, there's a particular link between the presbyters and bishops who in some mysterious sense share the priesthood, as it's described, in a way that is not characteristic of the diaconal order. And the latter, that is to say, the bishops lay hands on the one who is to be ordained, and the presbyters attend in silence. So the presbyters do not take part, they do not lay on hands in any sense during the ordination of the of a bishop. Then there's a description of episcopal function. If you drop down to the next little brown-colored box, there is a prayer which uses the language that we've already seen from the Didache of the beloved child, the Pais, the beloved servant, Jesus Christ, and then a description of what the bishop does. And you see this in the highlighted text. The bishop feeds the flock and exercises the high priesthood. This is important because at this period, and really into the 4th century, the term priest, hieros in Greek and sacerdos in Latin, was primarily used of, and in some cases restricted to, the bishop. The bishop is the one who exercises priesthood. Now the presbyters, the elders, and the word presbyter does not mean priest, it means elder. The presbyters share, as we shall see, in this priesthood of the bishop, primarily by delegation. The practice would have been that when the bishop could not be himself present at an occasion, the presbyter or a presbyter might preside in his stead, but with an understanding that this is done because he shares in the priesthood which the bishop primarily possesses. And in some cases, when the term sacerdos, in most cases, the term sacerdos in Latin, hieros in Greek, the specific terms for priest is used, you can rely on the fact that this refers to the bishop. And only secondarily, and in a kind of referred sort of way, to a presbyter exercising that function with permission and in the bishop's stead. It will not be till several centuries later that presbyters are regarded as priests in their own right, having the right to preside not just by delegation, but in virtue of their ordination. That's not the understanding at this period. The bishop is the one who has the high priesthood and shares in Christ's high priesthood. If you drop down to the next paragraph, he offers the Lord the gifts of the Holy Church. There is the language of offering of gifts used in reference to the Eucharist. He has the power to forgive sins. So it is the bishop's right to reconcile those who are guilty of grave sin. He has the right to offer the gifts, that is to say the Eucharist, and to reconcile sinners. It isn't until considerably later that presbyters will presume to be able to offer sacramental forgiveness of sins. And that's a separate issue in the development of the sacrament of penance and reconciliation. It is clearly the responsibility of the bishop at this stage, and his responsibility alone, to offer sacramental remission of sins. A form of Eucharistic celebration is offered, if you drop down, which represents very much the canon as we have it today. The preface dialogue, the Lord be with you and with your spirit, lift up your hearts, and so forth. Then a description of the of what would be the preface, and then the canon. It would seem that at this period, the bishop's an important responsibility of the bishop was to compose the preface. There were forms that existed, but he was not obliged to use a specific single standard form. Part of his charism was the ability to adapt and modify the preface according to circumstances. And when in early documents, particularly not in this document, but in later documents, the term concelebration is used, it means a visiting bishop who is allowed to share in offering the words of institution, and particularly in offering or composing the preface. That was a uniquely episcopal function, and the term concelebration in the early church refers to episcopal concelebration, not to a participation in the sacrifice, in the offering of the sacrifice by the presbyters. The idea of normal presbyteral concelebration is a modern, not an ancient practice. As we'll see, as the text describes, there's an anamnesis, a calling to mind and an invocation of what Christ has done for us, the calling to memory of what has happened, and then the epiclesis, the specific prayer for the descent of the Holy Spirit upon the gifts that are being offered. In the Eastern churches, this is of even greater significance in an understanding of the validity of, and even the moment of, or the time of, the change in the elements. One finds all of these elements in this apostolic tradition of Hippolytus, including a concluding doxology. Then there is, which is very interesting, a description of the blessing of offerings, which are part of the origins of the tradition of the Mass stipend. That is to say, the food that was being offered, much of it was for the care and upkeep both of the poor, who would receive a portion of it, but also for the care and maintenance of the clergy. And these offerings or gifts, which, as you see if you look down, include oil and cheese and olives and other kinds of things that were brought into the church and formally offered, these things were a way of participating in the offering of the Eucharistic gifts by the whole people of God, who gave these gifts for the support and maintenance both of the clergy and for distribution to the poor. And these gifts were formally blessed. There were just all kinds of food things being brought to the altar at this early stage. And there are specific prayers for blessing of these different items. And as we'll see in the later tradition, these prayers become even more specific, and other kinds of things are enumerated in terms of possible offerings. Then there is, in chapter 7 or 8, depending upon the enumeration, presbyteral ordination, the ordination of presbyters. Very interesting, because the bishop alone ordains the presbyter, a single bishop. Remember that in the ordination of a bishop, there were several bishops from other areas who came to take part, representing the Universal Church to some extent. Here in the ordination of a presbyter, it is only one bishop, his bishop, who ordains him. He lays on hands, and the other presbyters also impose hands, not, as we'll see, and this document makes it very clear, not that they are ordaining, but that they are in some sense sealing, we might say, welcoming the individual into this presbyteral confraternity. But this right to lay on hands, not as a part of ordination, but as a kind of a, if you will, a secondary sealing, is restricted to the presbyterate, and it is not paralleled at diaconal ordinations. Deacons do not lay hands on deacons when they are ordained. What is the role of the presbyter? Well, that's given. He helps the other presbyters and governs the people with a pure heart. So there is an assisting role, assisting in the college or the group of the presbyters who serve the local bishop, and also a participation in the governing as well. Then in the section on diaconal ordination, as we see, the bishop ordains the deacon, laying on hands, as it says in the manner prescribed, but the bishop alone imposes hands, because it says the deacon is not ordained to the priesthood. So there is a priestly function which is regarded as not being conferred at the time of diaconal ordination, but that exclusion of a priestly function is not mentioned in regard to the ordination of a presbyter, because there is a kind of participation in the priestly role which the presbyter has, again, not by right, but by participation in that priesthood, that high priesthood which the bishop has. The deacon is distinguished because he is not ordained to this priesthood, to the role of being a sacerdos. And indeed, other deacons do not lay on hands. Then there's a description of clerical distinctions in order to make it even more clear. This is the reason that the bishop shall ordain a deacon. On the presbyters impose hands because it says of the common and like spirit of the clergy. There is a clerical sort of spirit, a kind of a participation in function of participation that is present between presbyters and linking them to the bishop in a kind of, by delegation, priestly participation, even though the presbyter is not referred to as a priest at this stage, which is distinct from, different from what one finds in diaconal ministry. That, it says, is why the presbyter does not ordain the clergy, because it is the bishop alone who has the power to, as they say, give, that is to say, to bestow ordination. The presbyter is only sealing by laying on hands at the time of a presbyteral ordination. The bishop is the only one who can ordain. And then there's a very strong attempt to clarify that. Then in terms of what the deacon does, there's a description of the what would now be called the prayer of consecration at the ordination of a deacon, which describes that the deacon in particular is to bring into the Holy of Holies the offering presented by the high priests. So there is a ritual of serving at the altar, of bringing forward the gifts, that is unique to or specific to the deacon's liturgical function. Then there is an enumeration of other offices, not described, strictly speaking, as clerical offices at this time. In fact, it's clear that these individuals do not have hands laid on them as if they were clerics. And the specific offices that are mentioned are confessors, widows, and lectors. Now, the role of the confessor, that is to say, someone who has suffered for the faith, not unto death, not a martyr, but who is imprisoned or perhaps tortured, this person is regarded as having a very special privilege in virtue of that they can be given, as you see in the section under confessors, the honor of the presbyterate. That is to say, they can sit with the presbyters even if they have not been ordained to the presbyterate. They are given that right of being with them. This causes some confusion because, of course, confessors could be of either sex. And so you have people being given the honor of the presbyterate in virtue of being confessors, but not actually being ordained members of the clergy, and therefore not functioning in a clerical capacity. And of course, one could thus have women confessors so honored, which can cause some confusion, giving the notion that there might might have been ordination to the presbyterate of women at this stage, which was clearly not the case, although there were certainly women confessors who were honored as confessors and therefore offered the honor, the dignity of the presbyter, the right to perhaps sit with the clergy. However, if a confessor is to be ordained bishop, they must receive the laying on of hands. Intriguingly, there's a more flexible understanding of the presbyterate that a confessor would not necessarily have to have hands laid on him if he was to function as a presbyter. As we'll see, this changes, of course, with the passing of decades, and you, in order to function as a presbyter, must receive the laying on of hands in the later tradition. There is a description of liturgical prayer. Each is to pray according to his abilities. The bishop is to give thanks in the manner described above, but he doesn't have to use the form of words set out there. Again, the bishop has the right of composing the prayers or of adapting the prayers to the unique circumstances. This is part of the bishop's charism. Then if we drop down a little further, the widow is not ordained, that is to say, hands are not laid on her, but she is instituted, which is to say, set aside, described as having a particular ministry in the community, which does not entail the laying on of hands, as it describes a little bit further on, because she does not offer the gifts, but she does serve a liturgical function. Ordination, it specifically enumerates, is reserved to clerics, to members of the clergy, but widows are instituted, it says, on account of their prayer. So here is a clear description of women who were set aside for a liturgical role having to do with prayer, not ordained as members of the clergy, but regarded as serving a ministry within the church, which involves their institution. Again, a clear description of an order of widows, an order of what would also include consecrated virgins, and recommendations that they be tested before admission to this order in the early church.